Laying Up Treasure in Heaven, Commentary for the February 11th, 2023 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry. www.visitstillwaters.com. Which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. Matthew 7, verses 9 through 12. While our quarterly titles this week's lesson, Laying Up Treasure in Heaven, the actual appeal is to turn over wealth to the church. This brings up two questions that beg for answers. The first is, why? And the second is the basis for that why still applicable? What our lesson quarterly has revealed thus far in answer to the first question is an appeal to the Old Testament model of support for the Levitical priesthood. The mandatory tithes were for the support of the clergy, whether paid in coin, flesh, or produce. In addition, a system of free will offerings, often to expiate guilt, was established. The greater part of what was paid to the sanctuary was to be consumed by the priesthood. However, this system had its flaws even then. When Solomon dedicated the temple in Jerusalem, the tens of thousands of animals slaughtered in a day could not have been consumed by the priests before spoiling. The people probably helped to consume the offerings. Precedent had been set for this with the tithe when in Deuteronomy the people are told if the distance to the sanctuary was too far, they were to convert their tithe to coin by selling the livestock, etc. Then they were to take the money to Jerusalem and buy fermented drink and throw a party with the tithe funds. Those who point to the Old Testament as a basis for paying tithe to support clergy fail to account for anomalies like this. A further discrepancy occurs when we consider the purpose of the priesthood that is ostensibly being supported by tithes and offerings. They perform several functions. They were responsible for the care and maintenance of the sanctuary, and later the temple. Some were tasked with performing music for worship, which raises a question in and of itself. If we are asserting that we are following the Old Testament model for supporting the priesthood, why are church organists and choir directors not paid from tithe funds as they were in the time of King David and his son, Solomon? Even the temple guards were from the priesthood. Why don't we pay modern security guards from tithe funds? One might argue that they are not descended from Levi, but neither are our pastors and elders. But perhaps the greatest discrepancy is found in our appeal to the example of those priests who were actually offering the animal sacrifices day by day. Most would agree that these were genuine priests deserving the support of the tithe for the service they were providing. However, with the advent, ministry, death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus of Nazareth, we commonly understand that his sacrifice supplanted those daily sacrifices of old and accomplishes the remission and forgiveness those sacrifices could not. That being the case, what need is there of the Old Testament Levitical priesthood? And if there is no longer a need for their services, where is the need for the tithing system? Serendipitously, the early church eventually discovered that religion could be a source of great wealth. Many people led a hard life with little reward back then, and many still do today. But some of those same people contribute far more than they should to the church, both in time and money. Why? It is because they are told they will be rewarded in heaven for the sacrifices of today. While we understand that prosperity theology is a heresy that makes God into a vending machine, dispensing blessings in return for our coins, this teaching is little more than deferred prosperity theology. While some quote Malachi regarding tithe paying and refer to Jesus' words about laying up treasure in heaven, there may be little that is more offensive to God's love for mankind than an overweight preacher in an expensive suit telling his struggling parishioners they need to be more faithful in bringing money into the church. The sin becomes even more egregious when the sacrifices of those trusting souls are weighed against a profligate misuse of the funds poured into the church coffers. There may be more evidence of the riches being a curse to the church than there is of it being a blessing to the donors. The abuses are too extensive to document here, but the book Who Watches, Who Cares? Misadventures in Stewardship by Douglas Hackleman makes a good beginning of such documentation. Unfortunately, money is an irresistible temptation to many, and church leaders are not immune to that temptation, especially in the opaque atmosphere found at the highest levels of church administration. Money equates with power and influence as easily within cloistered halls as without. It shouldn't, but it does, and testifies, therefore, against the heresies of perfectionism and the desire to seek after the very prosperity that so many stumble at. Some may delude themselves into thinking that wealth will not be a stumbling block for them because they don't desire millions or billions of dollars. They only want to have enough to get by. But those who have trod that path can share that the idea of enough is nebulous, and as wealth grows, so do the needs to have enough. At some point, the house with two bedrooms is no longer enough, though a homeless person may see it as a dream fulfilled. At some point, only one car is no longer enough, though it might seem an impossible dream to the person walking everywhere. At some point, having enough food becomes no longer enough, replaced by a concern about the quality of food as opposed to quantity, and the price for that quality tells us we still do not have enough. By now, I hope it is evident that there is never a point where we can feel we have arrived at enough and switch to caring about others because our own needs have finally been satisfied. It is a golden carrot at the end of a string that ever hovers before us, leading us on. But if this is true for each of us individually, how much more corporately as a church? The corporate entity is only the total of the parts that make up the body. If wealth is such a trap for both individuals and the church, what are we to do? The church has never relented in its drive to bring ever more money into its storehouse. Just as the church hawks blessings in return for those streams of gold, Johann Tetzel 500 years ago hawked indulgences that promised salvation for those in purgatory. Half of the income from those indulgences lined the pockets of his archbishop, and the other half went to paying for work on St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. It was this kind of theology that Martin Luther railed against from the pulpit and led to the dawning of the Reformation. Nonetheless, the church prospers financially when we forget about all of that and foolishly give every hope for our financial future to the church, hoping for blessings that conveniently don't occur until after death. Conveniently, because it is hard to hold the church to account if we are dead and find no such overflowing blessing awaiting us. Or as in Tetzel's case, we die, end up in purgatory, and find our suffering relative still there, despite our purchase of several indulgences. Two places in Scripture, one in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament, are concise instructions on how we are to relate to the blessing of wealth and to one another. The first is found in Isaiah 58. Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen? To loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe them and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood? Then your light will break forth like the dawn, and your healing will quickly appear. Then your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer. You will cry for help, and he will say, "Here am I." If you do away with the yoke of oppression, and the pointing finger, and malicious talk, and if you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry, and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness, and your night will become like the noonday. The Lord will guide you always. He will satisfy your needs in a sun-scorched land, and will strengthen your frame. You will be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. Isaiah 58:6-11. The New Testament gives us a similar admonition in the parable of the sheep and the goats found in Matthew 25. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father. Take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." Then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me." They also will answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger, or needing clothes, or sick or in prison, and did not help you?" He will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me." Matthew 25, verses 31 through 45. It seems that God's intent in blessing us is that we use those blessings not for building the power and influence of the earthly church, but for relieving suffering, even as we would want our own suffering relieved were we in similar circumstances. For those who are trying to build a powerful church on earth, this is hard to hear, but it is no harder now than it was thousands of years ago. For those who would be perfect in their obedience to all they imagine the law requires, including the paying of tithe, Jesus had a simple answer. "If you want to be perfect, go sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me." Matthew 19, verse 21. This is the true measure of perfection. It is also the stumbling block for the perfectionist. May God help us all. Thank you for listening to this podcast. You can find the written version of this podcast, as well as hundreds more commentaries and podcasts, at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.